When you find reality is yanked violently from straight ahead to the hard insane right, you know you're off the beaten path. Defenestrate Media and The Left Show present The Sidetrack with Jason Williams.
Welcome to The Sidetrack. I'm Jason Williams. A long time ago on this very podcast, I said that the Democrats in 2020 need to embrace identity politics. And I know identity politics, it's a word that is never trotted out in a positive light. But as I've argued before and won't spend the time doing again, identity politics is something everyone does. In fact, identity is inseparable from every aspect of a person's life, including what they might describe in a poll survey or a caucus discussion, their public policy preferences. The only reason identity politics ends up being a negative term is that it's usually thrown out by white dudes, the older ones, in a negative light. And they're pretending, as they do this, that they aren't practicing their own form of identity politics, not only in doing that, but throughout their public policy preferences as well. That's not why I think Democrats need to embrace identity politics in this election. We'll get to that, because it seems like every goddamn week there is another reminder of why I think this is so important. But it's going to take a little bit of history and a little bit of looking into current conditions on the ground. One of the big issues over the last few years that just boggles me, there's even a debate about it. It boggles me that there are people out there that think this is just a group of people being whiny. The Black Lives Matter movement, the ask, if you think about what this was all about, it was literally a bunch of people saying, hey, we seem to be getting shot by the cops a lot, and we'd like that to stop. I don't understand what there is for anyone, including a police officer or a police chief or a president of a police union, as crazy as they can get. There's nothing to object there, too. Now, police, obviously, anytime they're criticized for being heavy-handed, are going to be defensive. But if you've got a group of people in your country, in your state, in your county, in your neighborhood, saying we're concerned about this, that we're getting shot by police officers so often, it's an opportunity for everyone to go, let's listen for a second. But of course, white people can't do that because we have a hard time accepting that we benefit from a system of structural racism that makes it easy for us to say things like, oh, identity politics are bad, as if we're not a part of it ourselves. No, what it is white identity is just it's the bar. It's the white identity is the norm that everyone, including people of color, have agreed to over throughout the history of this country in one way or another. And so it doesn't seem like identity politics when it's a white person practicing identity politics or embracing it themselves. But still, not the reason that I think Democrats need to embrace it this go-round. Take a look at some data to illustrate how complicated all of this is and why I've said before on the show that so far Elizabeth Warren seems to be the only presidential candidate that's doing a little bit of weaving of these issues together. In fact, it's one of the few things I really dislike about Bernie Sanders. I like Bernie Sanders. I think what he's done as far as moving the conversation in at least the first presidential run, this one seems to be a bit more of a flop, he's done a lot of good. And I don't think I've ever heard him say something I didn't like. But I get frustrated that Bernie doesn't do a bit more of what Warren is so good at, which is weaving all of these things together, because they are woven together. There is no separating debates and discussions over health policy from racial inequality and structural racism. There's no way to entirely separate those things. Now, you can say a state legislative discussion is happening and they don't have the time to wade into all of the minutiae of the public policy they're crafting, but they'd like to craft some good healthcare policy. Sure, you're not going to spend a lot of time in those settings discussing the history or the foundations of how we got here. You're going to be talking about how we can fix it. I get it. But there are also times when, if we're going to talk about how we can fix it, we do need to include a lot of this. And it seems like such a stupid word to use when you're talking about something like a group of people who seem to be getting shot by trigger-happy police officers a bit more often than a lot of other people. But nuance is the word that fits. There is a good deal of nuance to understanding all of these policies in order to craft good solutions through public policy where we can. And again, that applies to everything from tax policy, employment policy, education policy, family promoting policy, health care policy. There is no separating a person's identity and their experience around that identity in this country from their personal preference. But there's also no separating fully the history, the structural racism, the acceptance of white identity as the standard upon which all other identities are judged. There's no way to separate that out entirely from any public policy debate. And that's part of why I think Democrats should embrace identity politics finally. They've been on the cusp of doing so and have actually dabbled with it at times over the last 30, 40 years as a party. And obviously, Democrats in the realignment warmed up to, with some coaxing, civil rights policy and the civil rights philosophy of the time, in the 50s and 60s. And that's not to be ignored or you know, scoffed at because it was so long ago. It's still a big deal, and it still drives and defines the party in a lot of ways now, at very least by its membership and makeup. That said, the Democratic Party has had a hard time over the last, say, 25, 30 years post-Reagan. They've had a really hard time actually being that party and actually acting like that party. And so I think it's long overdue, and I've thought that for years, but there's something about this Trump era that I think makes it the, and one of my least favorite phrases every 4 years in this country is, this is the most important presidential election ever. They're all pretty important. There's a lot on the line, and the president, despite the fact that we hype up the power of the office and the ignore the growth of the imperial president, the president, him or herself, is actually not as powerful when it comes to some public policy as Congress. And that's worth remembering as well. But the president does, as we've seen here in the Trump era, set a tone. And as trivial as that sounds, Trump is the greatest example of how not inconsequential that is to have a president setting a tone. I think right now you can look around you, look at what's happening in this country, look at what we're seeing as far as some of the social data that's arisen over the last couple of years. And I mean, to put it simply, a lot of vermin have crawled out of the woodwork. We've got Nazis marching in khakis with tiki torches. That would have been a laughable thing outside of the Trump era. In the Trump era, it became a violent and deadly thing. These people are empowered. They're feeling like this is their moment. And I've spoken with some of them. One gentleman, I guess you'd say, told me that it was now or never for white dominance in this country. He was dead serious, too. And this wasn't an uneducated backwoods hick. This was a very educated, very intelligent man outside of being a fucking racist. And he told me, he said, it's now or never. Our movement has never come back from the civil rights era in this country, but we're seeing sympathies grow for what our message, he said, overseas. And this is an opportunity here in the United States. I was shocked both at what he was saying, but also my own naivety on being surprised by this. None of us should be surprised by this. None of us should be surprised that there is a very solid foundation that's still alive and still has a lot of blood pumping through it, white supremacy in this country. But I think this is one of the faults of the Democratic Party, in that they became the party of this, whatever this is, this set of public policy and ideologies over here that aren't at least overtly racist. And then they just hung out there. And what that actually causes to happen in this country, and has caused to happen in this country every time it's not challenged, is, well, think of the well-meaning environmental policy in which a certain thing that's really bad for the environment is banned, but then that leads to increased use of this other thing that is actually worse, or at least equally as bad for the environment in a more lasting way, but everybody's patting themselves on the back, you know, not to jump on the right-wing nut job bandwagon over straws. They're selling them literally to each other. This is the brilliance of American right wing right now, is they're selling straws to each other and patting themselves on the back as a movement. There is something to be said about all this energy being put into straws and a debate over straws, and public policymakers who fight the good fight when it comes to straws and then pat themselves on the back. I mean, there are bigger, more pressing issues right now when it comes to the climate and to the environment. But the straw debate will be how it's remembered and how it's thought about. And everyone who is on the right side of that will pat themselves on the back and say they did something. But did you? So translate that exact same thing into the realm of public policy as it pertains to civil rights, equality, fighting, which I think public policy can and has a responsibility to do, fighting racism, institutional or overt. And have we? I mean, really, the Democratic Party, have we done that? Or have we been sort of coasting on having our arms twisted as a party into being behind civil rights and then finally fully embracing it and even championing civil rights for a couple of decades and then just kind of coasting from there? This isn't to say that the Democratic Party is in any way responsible for Donald Trump. We'll get to that a little more detail on how the Republican Party most definitely is. In fact, they've been working on Donald Trump for about 40 years. They just didn't realize it, or maybe they did and just didn't give a shit. So this isn't to put the problems of our country when it comes to the lack of fight, really, against institutionalized racism and the status quo of white being what everything else is judged against. But it is to say that Democrats probably had more opportunities than they've taken to actually be that party. And I don't know. It's hard to believe the public pressure to be that party isn't there. It's really hard to believe that, especially at the state level, that there isn't a coalition that exists to speak for the marginalized. We know they're out there. We know they've been active. Why haven't they gotten as many ears and eyeballs? I don't know. Maybe that's the self-reinforcing power of the structuralized racism and white supremacy in the United States. And it just loops back to that again and again. So my point here is it's inseparable from public policy debates. You can't hash it out every time. I get that. Sometimes you're just going to be talking about healthcare and roads. But remembering that this history exists can be, I think, really informative for public policy makers, and also opens the doors a little bit more to them actually hearing and listening to marginalized people, people of color in this country that to date still have had to fight and claw for what little voice they're given in the institutions and the mechanisms of power in this country. So with that sort of as a primer, back to the idea of nuance, this was a debate that I think spells out what I'm trying to get at in this episode and how we think about all of this so clearly. It was a debate between some not crazy conservatives, some very rational, I don't know if the word moderate even means anything anymore, but these weren't militia members. These were intellectual conservatives that honestly have a big problem with where the Republican Party is right now, but still find it more of a home than not having a home. And some self-proclaimed progressives that seem to have a good grasp on what it is progressives believe. And so I was watching this debate play out, and I didn't chime in. I chimed in at first. That's how I kind of stayed plugged into the debate. And then I just backed off and watched what was happening. But the debate was over. So the Washington Post has been tracking fatal officer-involved shootings for years. And a few new studies have been published this year. The most recent was just July 22nd, just several days ago. And the data paints a pretty convincing, if not conclusive, picture. And it's not conclusive, but again, convincing picture of trends, if you will, when it comes to officer-involved shootings, civilians killed by police officers. And so here's what the data presented, basically. The data presented that there really isn't a clear statistical sign that the race of a police officer has as much of a predicting ability on whether or not that police officer will shoot someone. The data also paints at least a convincing picture that the race of a police officer did not seem to have any determinant power over whether a gun was even drawn or whether the race of the person being shot, whether that had any statistical impact on number of people shot inside a police department over a year's time. So it paints a muddy picture, basically saying, look, there might be something to this, but it's the data is not at all painting a picture of race being the biggest factor when it comes to the race of the officer or the race of the civilian when there is an officer involved shooting. It seems to be a bit more over the board and all over the board. And they present this by pointing out that that despite the fact that the data also says of civilians fatally shot, that they're predominantly of mixed race, meaning that there's no clear single race that is actually being shot more by police officers than any other until you start breaking it down. So that's national data. But if you start breaking it down to the county and community and single police department level, then you start to see these bright red lights at different places all over the country where absolutely in those areas, more black people or more Hispanic people are being shot. So that's the picture the data, just the raw data paints. And then there's a great couple of articles written about it. And so this debate that was happening online was about some of these articles. And again, you have these, you know, saner conservatives than we're used to right now, and progressives that seem very dedicated, seem very knowledgeable about what they believe. But at the same time, I'll get to my judgment on them. So I watched this debate play out, and what I see is you have, so basically the conservative side of this debate And I don't know what these people were. I just, from their arguments, I'm making some generalizations about which political ideology they might subscribe to. But so you have one side of people who are looking at this data and saying, see, Black Lives Matter is a bunch of horse shit that's just meant to make police officers who keep us safe look bad. And it's just a divisive measure used by black people who are actually the racists in this scenario. And then you have the other side saying this data absolutely has to be flawed. They only looked at 650 police departments, et cetera, et cetera. Now, that's, I'm not saying that that's an unreasonable argument. My point here is it was interesting to me how quickly the progressives jumped to tossing the data out. Because I've read this, and I actually, I'm pretty convinced the data, again, not conclusive in any way, but it's worth considering what the data presents here. But so for the conservatives, you had the typical predictable, it's black people who are actually the racists in this scenario, and see, they're not getting shot at any higher rate than white people, and the race of the police officer doesn't matter, doesn't seem to matter at all, according to this data. That's a very predictable answer. The progressives, though, just again, immediately just, oh, this is bullshit. This data means nothing. This is not even worth talking about anymore. And that threw me a bit because this is a credible set of research. And it's now been peer reviewed by three different universities, the paper published in this. If you'd like to read it, it's pretty easy to find. Just simply search for Washington Post tracked fatal officer involved shootings. You'll find a few links in the top of that Google search to articles from the Washington Post and the Guardian, and all of them link back to the original research and the data, the raw data, too, if you want to look at that. So I find it to be pretty credible, at least as a point of starting out when talking about this kind of thing from a public policy perspective. But again, the progressives were immediately throwing it out. One of the reasons that I realized they were tossing this data out is it challenged something that this, for them, was all about. And so I jumped in quick and I asked everyone's race. Some people called me a dick for asking. I get it. I'm sorry, but I'm doing sociology here online in my free time. But most people answered, and every single person was white. So let's just say for this argument, it was all white people. Maybe someone was saying they were, and when they weren't, I don't know. But so all white people discussing data that presents a bit of a challenge to some of the less nuanced takes when it comes to fatal shootings by police officers in the United States. The conservative side feels vindicated because it shows the race of the officer doesn't seem to be a huge determinant, and it doesn't show that the race of the civilian being shot is as consistently lopsided as a lot of people would think based on the conversation the last couple of years. So conservatives feel very vindicated, and they completely ignore the part of the research that says until you boil it down to certain cities and certain police departments, and then suddenly you see a huge racial disparity in the number of in the people shot by police officers, and you start to see a huge evident racial determinant on whether an officer is going to pull his or her gun and fire. Conservatives completely ignored that part. They just latched on to the top stuff and said, see, Black Lives Matter, total horse shit, we're vindicated, data backs us up. Progressives, on the other hand, completely ignored themselves that data, which would have been the first thing I jumped to if I were in this argument invested. The data that shows when you start looking at things more in a more detailed lens than the national averages, you start to see things get pretty damn racist out there when it comes to police officers shooting civilians. But they ignored that, and they instead start tossing this data out. And the reason I point this out isn't to really say either one of these groups are you know, total morons. My point here is that you have a bunch of white people talking about something that has some nuance to it, and unless the data that they can grasp quickly without having to think about it too much backs up what they already believe, then they're going to default to just not believing the data. It's confirmation bias in person. And that's exactly what's happening here. On both sides, you had conservatives confirming their preordained pre-concluded concepts of racial disparities in law enforcement, saying this data backs them up, but not wanting to dig down lower where in the data they say, oh, but there are some huge problems in large, heavily populated chunks of this country where it does look like white police officers are shooting a lot of black young men. Progressives ignored that exact same data because the data on the surface upsets them and says, well, there doesn't seem to be a national picture that can be painted that backs up the idea there is racial disparity in this. And then they're so upset about that lack of conclusion that they don't dig down deeper where they're what they claim to believe is 100% backed up by the data, vindicated on all fronts as a belief of the picture that actually, or the reality that actually exists out there that we're trying to paint with these picture, with this data. So that to me is what scares the shit out of me about now, more than Trump, because you knew Trump was coming. We'll get to that in a bit. You knew Trump was coming. Something like this was coming inside the Republican Party. They have been architects of this circus for half a century. You knew it was coming. What I didn't know was coming was a lack of counter, was a lack of, from the media not knowing how to talk about and react to this guy. We're still having debates on whether or not the media should actually say when the president says some racist shit that it's racist. That's a stupid conversation to be having. We're still having debates over whether or not you've got Maureen Dowd taking up valuable real estate at the New York Times, bitching because a bunch of people called her an elitist for going to a hosting a cocktail party with very powerful people. And now she's pissed at everyone on Twitter. Shut up, all of you. I mean, there is something really going on here that the media doesn't know how to handle. And that frightens me because we're 100% reliant on, to a large extent still at least, national outlets, legacy organizations, and unfortunately, cable news. It's still the predominant way information is disseminated in this country, all of them. And they do not have their shit together right now. They're acting like it and we're choosing to buy it, but they do not. But even more frightening to me, the Democratic Party was not prepared for this moment. The Democratic Party is not really in a position where they can, without some splaining, step up. And we're still at that part where the Democratic Party hasn't even begun splaining. And this goes back to these two sides I mentioned in this argument where no one wants to dig too deep on any of this. No one wants to dig too deep. So back to this data and back to this idea that this data says, you know, looking at a national average, there doesn't appear to be a very clear or consistent racial indicator when it comes to which officers might pull their gun and shoot a civilian. Nor does there appear to be a consistent racial indicator when it comes to a civilian. Who's the most likely civilians? What's the race of the civilian most likely to be at the other end of that officer's gun? It's inconsistent nationally, but on an average. But if you break it down to state, county, and community, you start to see a whole different picture. A whole different picture. Then you start to see these real racial disparities pop up where police force itself is 95% white. And 85% of the people they shot in a year's time were black. And so a lot of people will say, well, that's the makeup of the community. But the data doesn't say that. The data says the people, civilians, shot by police officers in a lot of areas of this country are more likely to be people of color. And police officers who pull their gun in some large areas of this country and fire at that person of color are more likely to be white. So kind of like the Electoral College, you have these large swaths of the country that are very homogenous and white, like Utah, say, where almost everyone's still white, and their data is drowning out the other areas of the country where racial disparities in law enforcement are very, very clear in all kinds of ways. And the data concludes for us that there is one glaring predictor of not only the race of a person fatally shot by a police officer, but also the race of the police officer, and also the likelihood of a fatal shooting in the first place. The only predictor consistent, whether you're looking at national averages or single police department data, the only consistent predictor was what you could call community factors. Violent crime rates, racial disparities in education, median wealth of the average person in the community, employment rates. All of these things were consistently predictors of a scenario where a white person shoots, most typically a young black man. By the way, the shooter is more likely to be male, too, than anything else. And they did account for gender makeups of police departments. They did account for racial makeups of police departments to eradicate anyone out there saying, well, it's just because there are more white officers. No, they accounted for that. And again, the only predictor was, I think, what a lot of us would call quality of life in their communities. If violent crime was high in the community, if education segregation or lack of funding for education was a factor in the community, if employment was an issue in the community in a negative way, wealth disparities, lack of access to health care, these ended up being predictors for whether or not a young black man got shot. So public policy, basically. Public policy that white people, for the most part, have been crafting for the better part of forever is to blame for whether or not a 17-year-old black kid crossing the street ends up a corpse than anything else. That should be impossible to ignore. That should be something that no one can learn and think, well, we just need to keep doing what we've been doing and we'll eventually get there. Let's maybe ask the centrists again how incremental they want the solution to be, and then we'll get back to you. No, it's not one of those times. It hasn't been one of those times really ever. But I think this is a time to say incrementalism, probably not enough at this point. Dealing with the fact that a good chunk of our problems in this country can be in one way or another tied back to inequality and white people writing too many rules without having any clue of the experience of a person of color in this country. Not every time we get an opportunity to realize our lack of understanding is going to be as big as President Dumbass tweeting against a member of Congress that that she should go back to where she came from. You know, this was a big learning moment for a lot of my white friends. Oh, what? That's racist? Yeah, it is. And by white friends, I mean white elected officials in my state. It's racist. And all you need to know to understand that is what that experience of hearing something as simple as a phrase like that is for a person of color. And spare me all you woke white people. We don't have a clue. We can't. The best thing we can do is actually listen and learn as much as we can about what the experience of a person of color in America is like. We will never fully be there because we're white. I mean, this is one of the hardest things for even the most dedicated and knowledgeable progressive out there to wrap their head around sometimes is that we, even though what we're fighting for is the dissolving of these institutional barriers to opportunity for people of color, even though that's something we personally subscribe to as a political goal and ideology, we still are incapable of recognizing how much we benefit from the existing system. We are incapable of fully being aware of, enough times for it to matter at least, of what it would be like in this country to not be white. Now, that doesn't mean we're bad white people. It just means we don't know, and we should be able to admit that. But you know who does know? People of color. Now, don't walk up to them and just start asking them. No. But listen, they'll tell you what the president just said. Fucking racist. And what did they get in response to that? Oh, you're being too sensitive. From white people. So, to really kind of ram my point home, I wanted to wrap all this up with a look at some ugly history. And it's history that is forgotten. And I first started really reading about this when I started hearing morons saying that racism was over after Obama was elected. And I heard that a lot. I live in Utah. In fact, I'm pretty sure I still hear that a lot. As well as, by the way, go back to where you came from, if you're curious. Also a frequent phrase here in very white Utah. I don't know if the two might be related. But this is a history of something that we've talked about. I know my contributions to the Left show here in the sidetrack segments, I mentioned this in a more lighthearted joking way, but I'm dead serious. Trump is not a cause. Trump is a result. Trump is where the Republican Party has been headed since the 1960s, at least. At least. And there are so many facets of this, it's impossible to really dig into every one. So I'm going to greatly oversimplify this, but go read about it. There's so much out there you can read about. And it's illuminating. Rick Perlstein's series, trilogy, that I can't remember the name of the first book. Second book is Nixon Land. It's an amazing three-book history of the Republican Party from the early 60s to Reagan, basically, as a movement and what happened internally. And it's a great history, but it's so illuminating as to how we got here to this point where we hear polarization. Everything's so polarized. No, just one party has gone apeshit and the other party doesn't know what to do with its thumbs when they're in power. That's all that's wrong. We're not too polarized. We are too polarized, but the polarization itself is a result, not a cause. Polarization is coming about because it doesn't look like anyone has their shit together. But let's not be both sidesing that polarization. When you look at the Republican Party, you are an idiot if you pretend the Democratic Party has gone anywhere in their own respective direction to that extreme. Not even close. And maybe it would be better if they did, sure. But the Republican Party right now needs to be burned to the ground, figuratively and electorally. I'm not arguing for single-party rule or some sort of weird dissolution of the Republican Party and then a split in the Democratic Party between the problem solvers and blue dogs and the rest of the sane Democrats. What I'm saying is the Republican Party has been able to kick down the road the lessons they've needed to learn to be a healthy party for a generation. This started in the 1960s with what can only be described as community activism by practicing Ku Klux Klan chapters in the South. Political realignment comes along. Democrats end up on the other side of where they came in, the Party of Civil Rights and the party that's at least acknowledging to some extent racial disparities in this country. Republicans dive into themselves and become the party that will honestly eventually elect Donald Trump. They embrace, especially when it comes to southern states, they embrace what's working for them. And to be honest with you, what was working for them is defending white privilege, playing to white grievance, and defending a racially oppressive status quo. Well, at the same time, making big hay out of Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday and the day of his assassination and any other civil rights icon holiday they could point a finger at or tweet a couple of things about day of, while behind the scenes being the party that basically embraced everything ugly about this country from the 1960s until Donald Trump. African Americans at one point were not allowed to register as Democrats in southern states. After the realignment, the Democratic Party became the party that was actually fighting for a Voting Rights Act, 1965. They became the party that was actually fighting for expansion of civil rights. They became the party that was fighting for raising awareness when it comes to white privilege and institutional racism. And then it just fizzled within the Democratic Party. It didn't go away. It just fizzled. Republicans, on the other hand, said, we're screwed. Thanks, Goldwater. Let's run with it. And let's hope there are enough frightened, angry, entitled white people out there that it'll work for us. And hey, get this, everyone. There were plenty. The FBI was involved in what became a very extensive surveillance campaign in the 1960s. And what they found was, now this has been made public only in the last decade, but what they found is that there were these huge community organizing systems and machines in the South. And what they also found is that the most politically active, politically engaged, highest voter turnout areas in the South post-1960 were also areas that, because they're the FBI, they knew, also had the highest level of Klan activity. Klan organizations spread across the 10 southern states, but and grew for a long time. Actually, they saw a boost post-1964, Civil Rights Act, and but what they noticed is that everywhere that the Klan was very active and very present, political activism, voter turnout, political engagement was also higher. So a couple of undercover stings later, and they realized, good God, the Ku Klux Klan is community organizing. Republicans, that's known history, right? We all knew that happened. They were gonna take the country back. They were gonna make America great again. They actually said those things, by the way, in the 60s. But what is missing from this analysis and the discussion about this bit of history is that Republicans said, and embraced it. And not overtly. They weren't burning crosses in people's lawns. They weren't showing up in press conferences with Cronkite with hoods on their heads. No, they, like I say, they were celebrating every civil rights icon's birthday and day of assassination as often as they could. Lofty quotes from Martin Luther King Jr. from this crowd. We still see it today. But behind the scenes, they became the party from a public policy perspective, from a messaging perspective, from a voter strategy perspective, from a candidate recruitment and bench building perspective, and eventually, just throughout, they became the party of white grievance. It wasn't an accident. White people didn't run to the Republican Party and say, we're grieved, give us a home. The Republican Party, rather, said, psst, hey, you pissed off, you can't wear your Klan wig and hat out in public anymore. You pissed off. You can't say the N-word on the streets. Come vote for us. It's okay over here in our private meetings, at least. That's literally the history here. The Republican Party wants to pretend the opposite. Morons within the Republican Party will actually make up history, Dinesh D'Souza, to counter this. But that is literally what happened. And in 2000, that election, you might remember, decided by an extremely tight race and a couple of hanging chads in the state of Florida, the historical influence of the Klan popped up then. It popped up in represented by the Bush campaign and the Al Gore campaign. The difference in the Republican vote share for Richard Nixon in 1960 and the vote for Republican George Bush in 2000, the growth in Republican voting has on average more than 15% higher still today in these Klan counties of the 1960s compared to counties that never had or quickly lost a large Klan presence. So again, Klan presence equates to more politically engaged Republicans in the South and higher turnout for Republican voters. You can have a chicken and the egg argument here if you want to, and there's a legitimate one to have. Do racists draw themselves to the Republican Party? Sure. I think they do, especially today, because where else are they going to go, right? It's at least somewhat friendly for them over there, because phrases like "go back to where you came from" aren't considered racist by Republican white guys. So they'll at least find a home in those respects. But this other aspect of it shouldn't be ignored. The Republican Party embraced, and even though they could never, they were smart enough to know they could never be caught working with the Klan, organizing with the Klan. But hey, if the Klan, say 1966, in one of these 10 southern states wanted to host a big rally about voter registration and getting people out to meet their candidates and passing out their pamphlets while they were there, no Republican's going to complain about that because it's going to help them in the polls, right? Same shit we're seeing today. Power over democracy, ends justifying the means, and absolutely no moral center when it comes to what's actually happening around us and the entire history that got us here. And people have said to me, do you really expect the Republican Party to throw the presidential election because Trump's a racist? Yeah. Yeah, I do. Here in my own state, I criticized the governor for what ended up being one of the most mealy-mouthed, both sides, loads of horse pucky I've ever seen in a statement after the president said, go back to where you came from, to a black congresswoman. The governor here in Utah said, everybody needs to calm down, basically. Weak. And not only weak, irresponsible. I get it. You're a Republican governor in Utah, and you say Trump's a racist and shouldn't have said what he said, shouldn't have done half of the things his campaign's been built around, shouldn't have kicked off the whole thing calling Mexican immigrants rapists. You come out and actually be a sane human being and say those very common sense things that you concluded by just paying attention to the damn news. Well, you're the Republican governor that's all over CNN right now as a party foil, right? I get it. We're wimps. Nobody wants to be that person, the lightning rod. I get it. I understand it. And to some extent, I even excuse it myself and in myself. But is it right? No. Is it noble? Absolutely not. Does it further things along in a positive direction? There's not even a question it doesn't do that. So for me, that is exactly why in this election, Democrats need to embrace this. They need to say very clearly to voters, here is our great candidate that we just spent way too long deciding on. Here is our campaign. Here are some public policy things you know we're about, and we're going to keep hammering those home. But primarily, here we are, the Democratic Party, with this candidate in this election saying, that man that's fooling nobody with his hair and his spray tan is an awful human being. that represents the worst of this country, not just in history, but still alive today, unfortunately. And your decision in this election is between that orange racist. I mean, just pause for a second here. Seriously, this guy's in his 70s and hangs out at golf clubs and country clubs. He's so white, he has to spray tan himself. We're going to be really, what? He's a racist? What are the odds? Well, the odds were really, really high that he's a racist, to be honest with you. Just demographically speaking, from what we've seen, the odds are high. But you don't even have to look there. You can even ignore Trump. You can look at the policies of the Republican Party, or more indicative of the institutional racism the Republicans want to maintain as a status quo because it's okay for white people. You can look at that throughout the years, and what they are opposed to is almost more revealing from a party perspective and a policy perspective of what they promote. You could go after that if you want. I think you should go after Trump. I mean, what's to lose here? Going after this guy is going to be one of the easiest things you can do, and if done effectively, could be one of the best things you could do, not just to win the election. No, I'm looking beyond that. What I'm hoping for in this election, and maybe that's too unrealistic, maybe I should say the realistic possibility is what I'm hoping for in this current era of American politics. It might go on a few years. But this is an opportunity to stamp this back. You can never stamp it out. There will always be scared people out there who have enjoyed privilege and are worried they're losing it. There will always be people out there that fear otherness and difference. There will always be people out there that have never left their hometown and didn't graduate high school. These are traditionally the pool for whatever the Klan is calling itself at any given time in history. And they'll always be out there. And it's tragic, and they're in their own way left behind by public policy too. I know it's hard to sympathize right now when Nazis are running people over at protests in Charlottesville, but they are left behind in their own way. Not nearly as much as people of color have been left behind, mind you, but in their own way. So that, to me, is what right now is kind of about. It's, and I really hope not. Maybe this is cyclical and it just has to happen every 50, 60 years. I don't know. But we're at that time, I think. I think it is time for the Democratic Party to once again be the party that says, no, not that. We are going to make sure this does not see a revival. We are the party that is decidedly against this, protecting this, and ensuring the status quo is maintained. We are going to be the party about change that is inclusive. We're going to be a party that is about breaking down some of this institutional racism. It can be done. We made the public policy in the first place. We can tweak it. That's what I want to see the Democratic Party become. And I want to see that also lead to, if necessary, a complete hollowing out of the Republican Party, at least to the extent where the Republican Party says, all right, guys, it's time to grow up and be an actual party. We had a good run on white grievance and institutional racism. We had a good run. Luckily, we were cutting tax breaks left and right for the most wealthy business owners out there, and they kept us in money. It was a good 7, 6, 8 decades. I really don't know when this started. We had a good run, but it's time for us to realize if we keep this up, we aren't going to be a party anymore. Now, maybe I'm being optimistic, thinking the Republican Party is capable of that at that point, which, I mean, there's quite an argument they're not. You just elected Donald fucking Trump as your standard bearer and then got enough grieved white people to elect him as president. Not your proudest moment, Republican Party. So I'm not entirely sure they're capable at this point of a reckoning internally. That doesn't matter to me. And what matters to me is that what the Republican Party is complicit in, what they're enabling, And remembering, again, you cannot separate identity, racism, your experience in this country based on who you are, which for people of color, yes, 100% does include the color of their skin because they are reminded of it every day. Ask any of them. It's inseparable from the public policy debates. And I want to see the Democratic Party own that and destroy by owning that. That's all they have to do. Own it and drive it home and reset this country. It's a lot to put on one party. And yeah, it's unfair. They aren't to blame other than they didn't fight this as much as they should have, especially in the Reagan years. But the Democratic Party right now, it's not enough to say they need to win elections. Yeah, that would be a lot better than what we've been seeing. But the Democratic Party right now needs to decide if it's going to be that party. The Republican Party can't. They're incapable of being anything moral right now as a party. So a complete rejection of Donald Trump in this election, but beyond that, a complete rejection of maintaining the status quo, a complete rejection of the subtle wink, wink, white privilege that built not only the Republican Party, but Donald Trump as president. All of that needs to be burned to the ground. Figuratively, again, I speak. That, for me, is why I say that Democrats in 2020 need to embrace identity politics like they never have before. We'll see if they've got the guts. I'm Jason Williams. We'll see you next week.